Each year in sports, records are shattered and championships are won. But the highly paid analysts get to tell you what to think about it. Who's listening to us, the fans?
This is Talk Back, where real fans get to express their own opinions and engage in heated debates about the world of sports as we see it. Welcome to the show. It's time for another edition of Talk Back. Justin, my voice is absolutely going out on me because here it is. We're actually recording this podcast on Monday, and my Eagles, fly Eagles fly, I just don't have much of a voice left after last night. Now, we normally record on Tuesday or Wednesday nights, most often Wednesday nights, put this podcast out Thursday mornings. We both have a hectic and busy week in our regular lives, and outside of that, we just knew that we needed to get this recorded and make sure that our Super Bowl reaction got out there. Justin, I have a lot of reactions. As you can tell from my voice, I was reacting all night long on Sunday night. But as I sit here today on Monday, the voice is the least of my concerns because the Eagles are NFL champions.
You sound like what most people in Pennsylvania sound like. You have no voice. I guess our fans really wouldn't know, though, if you were happy or sad based on the result of your voice, because you could have been screaming at the TV in a loss. But boy, your Eagles came to play on Sunday night, and wow, what a Super Bowl it was. We're going to break that down in segment one. We even go back to our preview show last week, talk about some of the things we got right, what we got wrong, what we really saw on Sunday night take place. And Eric, I for my money, I thought it was one of the best Super Bowls that I've ever seen from start to finish. What an epic game that was.
Yeah, I told a lot of people all weekend long that I wanted to see a close game. I wanted to see a back-and-forth game. I wanted it to be exciting, but I wanted it to be the Eagles winning. And I really got all of that, all of the drama I was looking for and the end result that I had hoped for. So after the break, we're going to come back for segment one. It's going to be all NFL, all Super Bowl 52 reaction, and I'm just going to sit back and relax.
On Sunday night, the Eagles won the first Super Bowl for the city of Philadelphia as they defeated the New England Patriots 41-33 to bring home the first Vince Lombardi trophy for Philadelphia. And I think it's still standing as of tonight, Eric, but probably not by much. Well, let's go back through and talk about really what we saw in this football game and kind of go back to our preview, because Eric, I felt like we really had a lot of things right in this game that we really hit right on the head. And again, if you're new to listening to our podcast, we don't talk about this stuff to bloat our egos or go on Twitter and make ourselves feel good. We really want our fans and our listeners and the people that take the time to download our show and to support us to really know that we try to be educated fans and we really try to take a lot of pride in the content that we put out there. So when we hit on a lot of things in this game, it's kind of a nice thing. And Eric, you really hit right on it as you took the Philadelphia Eagles to win this game straight up. Obviously, you're an Eagles fan and we're pulling for them. But you saw a pathway for this team to win this game based on their performance that we saw 2 weeks ago against the Vikings, that you were starting to get confidence. And really that led me to my question to kick off the preview show last week to you, which was, what Nick Foles would we see in the Super Bowl? Because the one thing that we know is that if you're going to beat the Patriots and Tom Brady, your quarterback has to at least match what Brady is doing. We saw that with Eli Manning. He didn't have to have the greatest game in the world, but he had to have timely drives. We saw it with Peyton Manning when he would defeat Brady. Didn't play the greatest game from a statistical standpoint, but he made the plays that needed to be made. And really, one thing that we have a lot of fun with is kind of the statistical look back. If a week ago I would have told you that Tom Brady was going to throw for 505 yards, 3 touchdowns, no interceptions, the Patriots would not punt the football in this game, would only have 1 turnover, I think you would have probably been happy if the Eagles stuck within 14. Now we're sitting here talking about the Eagles. They've won their first Super Bowl. And not only that, Nick Foles was the MVP of this game for your Eagles.
I couldn't be more pleased with what I saw on Sunday night out of both quarterbacks, to be honest with you. Like we said in the teaser, this was full of drama, this game. Although the Eagles' defense played well in spots, I think Tom Brady showed just how much he is of the greatest player of all time because he picked them apart. We said guys like Amendola, guys like Gronkowski, particularly guys like Hogan, you mentioned Hogan, I recall that, would be in this game and be highlight pieces for the Patriots, and they definitely were. So the Eagles were susceptible to that, and that left Nick Foles needing to throw the football, and he got it done. I couldn't be more pleased with how he performed under pressure. I look at a lot of the throws that he made. Not only did the line give him a lot of protection, but even when he was rushed out of the pocket, he made a lot of good throws on the run. He made some good throws on third down, even some throws on third down that didn't get caught. I remember one early in the game that hit Torrey Smith right in the numbers on the sideline that he dropped. Things like that, and you look, well, you can't be mad at Nick Foles for that because he hit the guy on the numbers. Take that throughout the game. And what I saw was just extremely impressive. Even the interception that Nick Foles had is just one of those bounce balls type of things.
It wasn't on him.
That's not on Nick Foles. Alshon Jeffrey, it hit his hands, and he really was trying to bat it up, but probably back to himself and make that play. Maybe just a little bit too much extra effort there. The ball gets picked off and intercepted, and unfortunately that goes on Nick Foles' stat line, which is something that really bugs me about the NFL. Once it's a batted ball, I don't really think that's a quarterback issue. But three touchdowns, one interception, and even, Justin, we'll talk about it in a bit, I'm sure, one receiving touchdown for Nick Foles. I couldn't be more thrilled with how he played because we said last week in our preview show, one of the keys to victory for the Philadelphia Eagles was going to be we needed the Nick Foles from the Vikings contest, not the Nick Foles from week 16 and halfway through week 17. We got the Nick Foles that happened in the NFC Championship game, and therefore, despite what Tom Brady did and all the yards he threw, Nick Foles kept up, the Eagles kept up, and they won the game.
And I really thought Doug Peterson coached such a great game. And I think, I don't know what these coaches do when they break down film, if they look at certain situations and say, okay, how would I handle that? How will I handle that if I'm put in that situation? But I think if he went back and looked at the Jacksonville film and saw Jacksonville up 10, just like we talked about 2 weeks ago in the recap of the AFC Championship game, Jacksonville had the football up 10 in the fourth quarter, and they immediately went three and out. And I think Doug Peterson, I think he had to watch that film and say, I'm going to keep my foot on the gas from minute as soon as the ball is kicked off until the confetti falls out, either for us or New England. I am not going to take my foot off the gas. I don't care if it's fourth down. We're going to go for it. We're going to go for two early in this game when it's going to look like we're chasing points. We're going to go for it on fourth down. Even that first drive, I thought their play calling was extremely aggressive. I mean, they came out and let Foles throw, and he really got into a rhythm. That first throw, he kind of looked a little shaky. It felt like he like came out really quick. It kind of looked herky-jerky, but he got the completion, and it's like everything settled down. And they marched right down the field. Even when they got down there, you know, they had the penalty. They backed themselves up in a goal-to-go situation, and it was like, uh-oh, is this what's going to happen? Is it going to be a repeat of last year with Atlanta where they just continued to make offensive penalties and back themselves up? But the defense came down. They held their ground. And at that point, it's just Nick Foles got into the football game. He started making big throws. Eric, that kind of leads me to one thing that I had tweeted about last night that I noticed early that ended up becoming quite the story was the Eagles went after Eric Rowe in this game. And I started wondering, why is Eric Rowe covering Alshon Jeffrey? What am I missing? And then you're kind of trying to find it of where is Malcolm Butler? This is a guy that made a huge play in the Super Bowl a few years ago in his rookie year, makes a game-winning play for the Patriots, and somehow he is not on the field, and the Patriots give up 41 points, and Bill Belichick is trying to sell it as doing what's best for the football team. How could it have got any worse? Were you shocked when you saw Malcolm Butler, a guy that played 98% of the snaps for New England, not on the field?
Not only was I shocked, I think a lot of people in the stands were shocked, and by the look of Malcolm Butler on the sideline, I think he was shocked because apparently that was news given to him. Now, the stories are still coming out about how this is all taking place, but I think that was news to him within maybe even hours before the game or certainly very recent history to starting that game. Yeah, I was very surprised. And so I think, you know, moving forward, whether it's this podcast or I don't know what you have, you know, here in your notes for the rest of this segment, but whether it's this podcast or down the road, I think we're going to be talking about not only Malcolm Butler, but things that Gronk said afterwards. We might be talking about Bill Belichick, whether or not he's going to be coaching this team, how this all shakes out. So this is a big loss for the Patriots because that Malcolm Butler thing possibly could be one of the cracks in the wall of this Patriots dynasty. As things like that, which don't seem like Bill Belichickian mistakes, that is maybe something that we see as the pieces start to fall apart here.
Because it's one thing, obviously Belichick's a disciplinarian and he, you know, he knows how to pull the right strings with his team. And that's fine in the regular season when you're playing Buffalo or Miami or even the Jets. But you're in the Super Bowl. You're in the pinnacle of your season and you make a move like this. I think it sort of sells out the team that you're really not doing what's best for the team. You're doing what's best for you. And I just don't see that how that they can try to sell that as that was what was best for this football team, because they just got eaten up by Nick Foles all night.
Yeah, it's very much like bowl games in college where, you know, there's 50 other players on this team that are going for a bowl championship. There's 52 other players on this NFL roster that want that Lombardi trophy. They want that Super Bowl ring. So I go back and forth with it. I mean, as a father, as someone who knows the value of discipline and showing, you know, merit and honor in all of your decisions as far as value consistency. But I'm not really sure that in a professional business like the NFL, that the Super Bowl is the night that punishment is the best opportunity to teach this man, Malcolm Butler, or this team a lesson. Because there's potential that it costs 52 other guys who have now put in the last 12 months of work for this one night, and there's a piece missing. I don't really think that that's the best move. Look, there's other ways to, maybe you find Malcolm Butler. Maybe he sits the first game or two of next year, although rumor has it that he won't even be there next year, or the first few series, or there's other ways around this. I don't know. It's hard to extrapolate what value he would have played or if the Patriots would have won. People saying that, well, the Patriots could have won if Malcolm Butler was playing. I don't think we can go that far. But can he make a defensive presence and change matchups on the field when the Eagles have the ball on offense? Yes, absolutely he can. And so that, to me, was where it got a little bit shady, because the game plan changes, and I think Peterson could just see that after the first half, make adjustments, take advantage of that. Eagles kept their foot on the gas, like you said, and hey, looking back, the Patriots are going to have to look at that as possibly one piece that went wrong here.
Well, that seemed to be a big change in the game and the momentum for the Patriots even to start out. Like I said, one thing I noticed running the Twitter account that I put out there, if you look at our timeline, was the Eagles had a bullseye on number 25. They went after him early. You saw Alshon make a move that Roe bit on. He got beat for a big play, and then he got beat over the top for the touchdown that made it 9-3 in that game. Eric, there was a ton of big plays in this game, but watching it, what was the play to you that you really felt like swung the momentum back as an Eagle fan watching it, that you really felt like it could be your night for the Eagles?
Oh, I'd say there's a couple of them. I mean, Blount had a 36-yard rush at one point, at a time that rushing momentum was really important because the Eagles were hitting them on both fronts. And so as Nick Foles was continuing to throw the ball downfield, it was nice to see Ajayi and Blount so involved in the offense. I feel like Doug Peterson didn't give up on the rush at all. You did see the Patriots kind of battling that back and forth all game long. Even on that final series where the Eagles were marching it down and running time off the clock, it was still this odd mixture. Made me a little bit nervous about the Atlanta game last year in the Super Bowl. But it was still this odd mixture of a little bit of running, a little bit of throwing, a little bit of running, but they didn't go away from their plan. So I was really impressed by that. The other player, and he was another running back, but Clement, he had a 55-yard reception. Anytime you're gaining a catch for over 50 yards, you're changing the ball game, no matter if that's in the first quarter or the fourth quarter. I look at that Clement play as, again, another weapon that the Patriots said, oh, wow, that wasn't Nelson Aguilar, that wasn't Zach Ertz, that wasn't Alshon Jeffrey. That was Clement that just busted us for 55 yards. And so I was really impressed with how Peterson used all of those guys to really have a well-rounded attack during this entire ballgame.
Yeah, I felt the biggest play I felt really swung the momentum where I knew Philadelphia was going to stay in this game was coming out of the half. New England goes right down the field, gets a touchdown, and basically it was very reminiscent of that drive that they had in Pittsburgh where it was just Brady to Gronk, touchdown. And they just march right down the field, and then Foles and the Eagles come right back down and get another touchdown to keep it at 10. And I really felt that was a big momentum swing because it was a big blow to the Patriots. It kept them back. It wasn't like they just went 3 and out like we saw in Jacksonville. And I think it kind of stunned the Patriots of like, uh-oh, we're in a ball game now. Like, we're going to need to score a lot of points.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with you there, especially as a fan, someone whose heart was extremely invested in the result of this game. You're exactly right. When the Patriots came out of the half and it was Gronk, touchdown, I looked at my wife and I was like, uh-oh, you know, this is what I don't want to see, because that's, you're exactly right. That's what the Patriots can do, and they can do it very, very quickly. So when they came back and scored, kept it at 10, I was really happy to see that. So I have to agree with you on that one. The other thing I really look at, now I know this is late in the game, but you asked me, at what point did I feel very secure that maybe this was actually going to happen? It was on that last drive for the Patriots. I know it might seem like you're lobbing this up and it's an alley-oop and I'm throwing it home. But look, the defense hadn't made a huge play all game. I said in last week's episode that one of the keys to victories for the Philadelphia Eagles was going to be points off of turnovers. I really thought that they needed 7 to 14 points off of a pick six or a fumble recovery, touchdown, that type of thing, because Tom Brady's just that good. Tom Brady didn't give them that all game. And yet, you give the ball to Tom Brady, you're thinking Atlanta all over again. They're going to march down the field, they're going to score, get the two-point conversion, probably go into overtime, and then all bets are off because it's you know, I think if you go to overtime, at that point, it's really, then it does become Tom Brady versus Nick Foles. And I wasn't comfortable with that situation. But at that point, the defense come up with a huge fumble for Tom Brady. And at that point, Justin, to your question, when did you really feel secure? I felt like that play was the one that secured everything, not just logistically because of the time frame left on the clock, but because it was really the first time in the entire game that the defense, although they played very well, that the defense took anything from Tom Brady.
Now, the big play right before the end of the half, you're an Eagles fan, you're sitting there watching it, your team's got the lead in this game. What, under a minute left in the first half? Now, you know the Patriots are going to come out and get the ball at the half. What did you think when you saw the Eagles come out, line up for it, to go for it on fourth down? Were you happy with that call initially? Did you want them to kick the field goal? What were your thoughts there?
No, I wasn't surprised at all. And also, all of the people that I was at the party with will attest to this. I said they should go for it because they have the defense that they do. Even if they turned it over on downs at that point, giving the Patriots a 99-yard field, I really felt like the extra down was worth the extra opportunity for 6 points. What we saw after that blew my mind. But I was very happy that they took that chance, because you never know in this game and against these Patriots when 6 points is going to be better than 3. And look at the end of the game. Things like that really came to play, where you needed every single point because Tom Brady was going to go all the way the distance and win that game for the Patriots unless the Eagles had every possible point they could.
Yeah, that's one of those plays that goes both ways. If they fail and the Eagles don't win, the media kills Doug Peterson for it. Obviously, it worked well and he pulls out one of the great trick plays that you're ever going to see. I mean, that's got to be the gutsiest call in the Super Bowl, obviously since Sean Payton's onside kick call. But in that spot, knowing how important points are going to be when you have pretty much a sure shot at 3 and you pull that play out, I mean, of all places to go for it on fourth end and you pull out basically a double reverse and then the tight end's throwing it to your quarterback, crazy play. Obviously, I think it came out Nick Foles actually ran that in high school. At some point, they ran a play where he caught a ball, and they had actually run that play, I believe, in 2015 versus the Vikings, and actually had it in the game plan to run 2 weeks ago and decided that the Vikings may be able to sniff it out and decided to save it for this game. Obviously, they saved it for the perfect time. Eric, another big controversial play in this game that I didn't think was controversial, but obviously Twitter makes everything that way, was the Brandon Cooks hit that he took. If you saw it, obviously, it was a big-time hit delivered by Malcolm Jenkins. But I don't understand where there's controversy coming in at or what people think Malcolm Jenkins is supposed to do. Brandon Cooks at that point is well-established as a runner. In fact, he was so wide open, he sort of was running around in circles and did not pay any attention to his left, and he got blown up. And you could tell by the way he reacted, how he was down the field, taken straight to the locker room. His night was going to be over. What is your reaction to the people saying this? I know you were following some people on Twitter talking about it. I didn't see it being anything that had to do with controversial at that point. It really wasn't any different than what we saw happen to Travis Kelce in round one of the playoffs. But what's your thoughts on that?
We've talked about it on previous episodes. We're certainly going to defend the player. And when there's unnecessary hits, especially targeted headshots, we hate those types of hits. We don't feel that they're good for the game. We talked about it several times this year with poor Davante Adams, some of the hits he took. This is a different situation, and I'll tell you why. When Malcolm Jenkins launched his body, if you look at that replay, in my opinion, now I know I'm an Eagles homer, right? But in my opinion, if you look at what Brandon Cooks is doing, almost like twirling around there, doing like a hokey pokey or whatever, his back is facing Malcolm Jenkins. In other words, Cooks is facing the other way when Jenkins commits to the tackle. I don't think either one of them knew what was about to happen. In other words, Jenkins didn't know that Cooks was going to make a 180 and try to spin and go the other way.
And turn right into him.
And so I think it surprised both players. I don't think Jenkins was intending to hit him in the face mask chin area. And I have to believe that Cooks had no idea he was there. He wouldn't have turned like that. So no, in my mind, this is nowhere near the Devontae Adams play, the Juju Smith-Schuster and the Gronk and on and on and on. These are not those plays. This is just a football bang-bang play. I don't think Jenkins had anything to do with being dirty on this. And I also think Brandon Cooks was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. When he turned around, it was like getting hit by a truck because he turned right into a big defender going right at him.
And it definitely changed the game for the Patriots because it took away their deep threat. And you saw the success they had even with Chris Hogan in that game. Coming into this Super Bowl, I believe I saw a stat where Brady only had one play over 35 yards in his previous seven Super Bowls. In this game, it felt like he had multiple plays well over that. That the Patriots just...
three of them.
They chunked them at some points. And it almost felt like the reverse happened of what we talked about last week on the preview show of what the New England Patriots would try to do. And you saw it early that they were trying to play with tempo and they were going no huddle. But the fact is, there was two things I think that seemed to happen. Number one, Brady was only 28 of 48, which is down from what he normally is. So that gave them 20 incomplete passes where the clock is stopped and Philadelphia is able to make substitutions. The other thing that I noticed was, from a play standpoint, it was 72 plays for the Patriots, 71 for the Eagles, but the Eagles had a 10-minute advantage in time of possession in this game, which is seemingly unheard of to see plays that close and the time of possession be that far off. When you look back at the game log, you actually see the Patriots, when they scored, it was fast. 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and the Eagles had slower, more methodical 6-7 minute drives, and it seemed like they couldn't wear the Eagles out. And you saw at the end of that game, they were limited on their deep threats down the field, and that Eagle pass rush still had plenty of gas left in the tank, unlike what we saw with Jacksonville. And really, it seemed like it worked against New England that they were having so much success because they really couldn't wear Philadelphia out. And it actually paid off at the end of that game because that pass rush for Philly was just coming those last two times the Patriots had the ball. Obviously, you alluded to the huge play that Brandon Graham causing the fumble of Brady. But even the end of that game when Brady was trying to throw the Hail Mary, Fletcher Cox laid him out pretty good there at the end of that game. And so I really felt like that was a big turning point, losing Cooks, losing that deep threat, because they were having success with it. Even the play Cooks got hurt, he almost got hurt because he was so wide open. He caught the ball. It's like he didn't know where to go because he had so much open space. Unfortunately, he made about the worst decision he could possibly make. Eric, when we talk about the other big controversial plays coming out of this game, it involved two touchdown catches that both went to review. Obviously, for the Patriot fans, they feel like they got hosed. They got taken advantage of. Obviously, the Eagle fans are upset at Chris Collinsworth. I saw on The Ringer had an article that he's public enemy number one. But it seems to stem more from the fact of just the complete and utter confusion over these catch rules, something that we have talked about all season long, that even the commissioner talked about in his State of the Union address for the NFL, that the catch rule is priority one this offseason, trying to clean that up, trying to make it a more simplified process. We can start kind of with the Ertz catch, because I thought that was the one that really was more of the no-brainer at that point. But I know it goes back to the Jesse James catch and some of the other plays we've seen where guys have gone to the ground and the ball has popped loose. But I don't know what people think. Zach Ertz, obviously, he had taken four steps, and then he dives, and the ball comes out. I felt like he had established himself as a runner once they clarified the rule. To me, Eric, that one made total sense.
I didn't understand why Chris Collinsworth was so inept in that moment. I mean, I understand that from these catch rules and how muddy the waters have become from how Roger Goodell and the NFL officiating crew has just really been so, it seems like, inconsistent, but really they've been consistent with what the NFL rule is. It's just that the NFL rule is really nuanced and, quite frankly, really dumb. So if they need to simplify that, as you said, I think that should be a project that they really focus on. But the Jesse James play and the Zach Ertz play weren't even really the same. Jesse James caught the ball, turned around, and dove for the end zone. He really didn't even take many steps. Or one term that has been not thrown around the past few weeks that always used to be thrown around is, did the player make a football move? Well, what's a football move? Zach Ertz took four steps. If that's not a football move, I don't even care if he's establishing himself as a runner or not. They always used to talk about, you know, is that a football move? And they used to count turning your body and taking one step, as long as you still had the possession, as making that football move. Ertz caught it, turned around, took four steps, and then intentionally dove. I mean, at the very worst, you could say that he fumbled when he hit the ground and then recovered his own fumble. There's so many ways to go with this, but the one way that they absolutely couldn't go is that it was an incomplete pass. And I'm telling you right now, Justin, I got through all of the anthem stuff okay, and I made it through the season, but if they had overturned that play, not only because I'm an Eagles homer, but because it would just be absolutely asinine for the sport of football, if they overturn that play in that moment and say, that's an incomplete pass, then as a fan, I have no clue what I'm doing, and I probably wouldn't turn it on next year.
And I think that's part of what the reaction from Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth was. You got to remember, these guys are in the booth for multiple games a week. You know, they're doing some of the Thursday night games, obviously the Sunday night package. And they see these plays all the time where they say, well, that looks like a catch. That from the eye test, from a common sense, that looks like a catch. Official comes out from looking at the Microsoft Surface tablet and it's an incompletion. And they go, what? That doesn't make any sense. So I think in this particular situation, when you've had the Dez Bryant catch versus Green Bay a few years ago in the playoffs, you had the Jesse James catch in a big spot this year, when that ball pops out, it's like, okay, at what point was he an established runner? At what point can the ground not cause a fumble? At what point can the ground cause a fumble and he not complete the process? So I think, again, I blame it not on those guys. I blame it more on the league for the fact that the rules are so confusing and are so convoluted, where you have professional broadcasters, and I think Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth are the two best in the business in terms of breaking a game down and keeping it entertaining, and really from a knowledge base, they're on top of their game. And we even saw it with the Jesse James play with Tony Romo and Jim Nantz, where it took those guys 30, 40 seconds to go, wait a minute, this is getting reviewed because it could be overturned. I think for these announcers, it puts them in a bad spot because these guys are former players. They watch games, they watch film, and they don't know what's going to happen either. It's almost like a game of roulette. And I really felt like the play I thought was closer to needing to be overturned was Clement's catch, because I felt like the ball was moving in his hand. Now, from an eye test and a common sense test, that's a touchdown. But from the way the NFL has basically ruled on those plays all year, anytime there was any type of movement with the hand and the ball, the NFL would basically say that's a non-catch. And I thought that was another play where, again, I don't think Collinsworth was trying to be a Patriots homer or against the Eagles. I felt it was another play where these guys go, well, we've seen X number of other games where a player catches a ball on the boundary or in the end zone. There's movement. They look at his feet positioning. Oh, he didn't get 2 feet in. It's an incompletion. So I think the NFL is causing this controversy among everybody, where it's creating this sense of people are against the Eagles, or they want the Patriots, or the Patriot fans are mad and people don't. They feel like things are rigged. But really, I feel like, Eric, it just comes down to the fact of there's a sense that the NFL just needs to fix this and go to more of a common sense rule. If it looks like a catch and the common sense tells you it's a catch, just make it a catch. But it almost felt like that play has been called not a catch a lot this year, and the NFL almost tried to fix it on the fly to do the right thing in the biggest moment, and then that creates the controversy.
One of the simplest things they can do is this whole, is the ball like barely moving in the guy's hands? I'm with you on the Clement catch. I can see where the adaptation of the rule and sort of the micro judgment of the rule could be applied and say that play needed to be overturned. When I look at it and I look at it frame by frame, I see him catch the ball. He clearly has it in his possession when he takes the first two steps. Let's say at that point he had run out of the end zone. That's a touchdown. The problem is he was still in the end zone, and so then that starts to work against him, because I think what they did to apply the rule, and I'm just pontificating here because I don't know, obviously, But I think the way that they applied the rule is that there is a nuance. We keep talking about nuances. There's a nuance to the rule that the receiver is allowed to shift the ball to clutch it in the one arm. And I think maybe, if anything, that's what they drew on, because he never bobbled the ball. I wouldn't call it a full-on bobble.
It definitely was an egregious movement.
It moved. And what it did is he caught it. And it looked to me like after the first two steps, he moves it over to his right arm and clutches it like a running back normally does. And then his other foot is, you know, the third step he takes, I think, was on the line. So I think that third step was out. So they couldn't go with that being, you know, in. They had to take the first two steps, the fact that he caught the ball. But then when he went to the ground, he had full possession of it the entire time through the ground. And so when you have these nuanced rules, like the Zach Ertz one, like the Jesse James one, and now like this Clement one, you're going to be able to say, okay, this part of the rule applies here. Uh-oh, we're a little bit trouble here. Well, then Clement went to the ground. He maintained the control of the ball all the way through the ground. He gets up from the ground with the ball in his hand. I mean, 99% of that play looked like a catch, except for the one part where he's shifting the ball as he crosses the back end zone line. I agree. As announcers, Collinsworth, Michaels, they're looking at it and going, I don't know. I mean, you know, nine other times this year, that wasn't a touchdown. This time it is. We have no idea. I will say this, though. Collinsworth, in my opinion, I mean, he's a good announcer, and they've done a great job. I've never had a problem with those guys. But for whatever reason, and this isn't even about the refs. I mean, I was pretty happy with the refs. There was a lot of non-calls on both sides. I thought, quite frankly, I thought the Pats got away with a lot of non-calls on pass interference. But we said last week, let's just not even get into the ref stuff. It just bothers us. So we don't need to get into that. But it seemed to me like Chris Collinsworth had his lips taped to the back of Tom Brady's butt for the entire game. That's what annoyed me. It's like it really seemed like he was rooting in his mind for Tom Brady to get his sixth ring. And I think that's really what bothers me. Not so much their analysis of those calls, of those controversial calls, things like that. I understand. Those guys are having a tough time. Just like us as fans, having a tough time from our couch trying to figure out what the heck the NFL catch rule is from day to day. I respect the fact that as announcers, they're having that same problem. But, I mean, there was plenty of other times, I can tell you, that Chris Collinsworth just seemed like he was ready to go down and hand the Lombardi Trophy to Brady before the game even started.
Well, you can now join the other team in Pennsylvania that doesn't like Chris Collinsworth very much, the Steeler fans, so at least the state can be united in that front. Well, Eric, now, do you have a quarterback controversy on your hands? I know the answer that you're going to have, but obviously there's people on the old Twitter sphere pontificating that there is a controversy somewhere. I guess they didn't watch the first 14 weeks of the season to see how good Carson Wentz really played as a second-year player. So what do you think your thoughts are now? Obviously, Foles under contract. Carson Wentz going to be going through rehab process, part of the offseason program. I'm sure he's probably going to be extremely limited or be out for, so it would behoove the Eagles to keep him. But a lot of teams in this league do need a starting quarterback. So if someone came knocking on the Eagles' door with a second-round pick, potentially a late first-round pick, what are your thoughts?
I think you got to be careful if you're the Eagles. And by the way, no, there is absolutely no quarterback controversy here. I even think Nick Foles would tell you that there's no quarterback controversy here, because I think he's a reasonable man, has a good head on his shoulders, and understands what occurred here, that Carson Wentz was 12-2, got injured with a catastrophic season-ending injury, and Nick Foles came in. The results of his success in the last 3 weeks and then through the playoffs does not make him supersede Carson Wentz as the starter. That's just not how it was going to be. That's not how it was ever going to be. Do I respect what Nick Foles did for the city of Philadelphia and their football team? Absolutely, I do. I think he showed an amazing amount of talent and gusto in a time that, quite frankly, everybody had written that team off. I'll sit here and tell you that in that first game against Atlanta, when we did the preview show for the divisional round of the playoffs, I didn't have the Eagles picked. My confidence grew throughout the playoffs. That Vikings game showed me everything, and then I picked the Eagles 28-24 to win the Super Bowl, because I had changed my mind. But if you ask me, if they win the Super Bowl, does that supplant Carson Wentz as a starter and Nick Foles next year is your starter? No. I mean, that's just not reasonable. Look at what Philly gave up to get Carson Wentz to move up in the draft. They had their guy. They've invested in this guy. And by the way, he wasn't a bad quarterback. He got you to 12-2. The end result,
MVP candidate.
the end result of this season was probably going to be the same now that we can look back on it and say, okay, Nick Foles led this team to the Super Bowl, won the Super Bowl. He had a phenomenal performance. But remember me saying, Justin, last week on the preview show, there are 52 other guys that want to win this Super Bowl. So I'm not so sure that the result, assuming Carson Wentz just plays like he did for the first 14 weeks, wouldn't have been the same. Maybe this was just the year for the Eagles, regardless of who was at quarterback. Nick Foles played great. I think Carson Wentz would have played great. This team was destined to win this year, apparently. That doesn't mean Nick Foles is your starter. So the options are there. I think you want to be careful, because if you're the Eagles, I think you go to Nick Foles. I think you bring Carson Wentz in on that meeting. They have a rapport now, and I think you say, look, we're a team. Wentz, Foles, the coaches, Peterson, we're a team here. We'd love to have you stay, Nick. You might be able to give us through the first few weeks of the season if Wentz isn't healthy to start 2018. We'd love to have you back. If you want to test the market through a trade or whatever, we understand that. But make sure you get full value for Nick Foles, because I said 4 weeks ago, he's probably in the top 10 of backup quarterbacks. So now if there's teams coveting him, maybe Cleveland doesn't get what they want out of some of these, either the draft or some of the trades prior to the draft. Maybe there's teams that look at Nick Foles and say, okay, we'll give him one more chance to be a season-long starter. But be careful. If you're the Eagles, I say be careful. Nick Foles, this might be his sweet spot. There are quarterbacks who the backup role is quite frankly just their sweet spot. He might have another good 4 to 5 years behind Wentz and do perfectly well and perfectly serve that team. That might be good enough for Nick Foles. I don't know. So I think it's up to him, and I think it's up to the Eagles to decide what's his value and where do we go from here. But no, he's not the starter in 2018.
And Nick Foles last year signed a 2-year, $11 million deal. So the Eagles have his rights for this year. And again, I agree with you. Remember, Nick Foles popped onto the scene and kind of flashed and had a terrific year. He was with Chip Kelly some. He had that run where he had 27 touchdowns, 2 interceptions. But I think you hit it right on the head. This is a system that just fits him. And Doug Peterson molded this team and this offense around what he does well. And we talked about that as we were looking ahead to the playoffs. Hey, this Eagles team, they have a bye week. That's going to give the coaching staff a week extra to sit down and figure out what Nick Foles does well. And when they went back through and watched the film, the one thing they found that he did really well was those RPOs, those run-pass options. And you saw it in that Atlanta second half. When they unleashed that thing, he was like a different quarterback. And all of a sudden, you were like, man, this dude might have something. We didn't see this the first 3 weeks of the regular season that he started. Now, all of a sudden, this guy really seems comfortable with it. They sprinkle it in right. It just seems like you said, this is the right system. Doug Peterson punched up all the right numbers. We've already seen Nick Foles in systems that don't fit him. He didn't have a lot of success. Now, obviously, Jeff Fisher's part of that equation. And if you've listened to this pod enough, you know what we think of Jeff Fisher and basically the destructive nature he is on an offense. But again, it has to be the right system, I think, for a guy like Foles. It seems like he's going to be perfectly happy to stay in that system, be a very well-paid backup. He knows what the starter's life is like. Again, this is more of Twitter talk. This is more of talk radio talk that people bring this stuff up. There's no way he's going to supplant Carson Wentz. He's a great option to have behind Wentz. Obviously, they get along very well. The backup quarterback can be a tremendous help for the starter to prepare. We saw what Wentz was doing with Foles to help get him ready. Obviously, Foles can have that same type of impact on Wentz when that quarterback room is right. QBs all the time talk about, hey, that's what we want, that relationship with the backup quarterback, the quarterback coach, and the starter. Seems like it's all clicking in Philadelphia. I don't think, Eric, that they're going to look to change that. But as we end segment one here, Eric, your Eagles, Super Bowl champions here now in 2017-2018.
E-A-G-L-E-S, Eagles!
And with that, we'll go to segment two when we come back for the break, and we'll talk about something else outside of football.
The NBA season is almost to the All-Star break. Unfortunately, there's some star players, All-Star players even, who are getting injured at this point in the season. Cousins, boy, that Achilles injury just really tough to look at, because, you know, any league, whether it's baseball, football, basketball, is always better with your star players. I'm always going to say that. I'm always going to be on record as having said that. And so you don't like to see that. But what you're starting to see is this trade deadline looming. Justin, we're recording this, as we said, on Monday night. It's going to release on Thursday. Thursday is the trade deadline, so there may be things when this podcast hits the airwaves that have happened between tonight when we're recording and unfortunately Thursday when it drops. But we know that coming back next week, we can deal with all of that stuff after it happens, let the dust settle and see what we're left with. But Justin, I want to bring something up because for our listeners who caught us in the middle of 2017, in the summer of 2017, I know specifically you brought this up. You're someone who looks at basketball contracts. You understand pretty well how things work as far as player movement and things like that. One of the things that I recall you saying is that the 2016 salary cap boom was going to really mess this league up. Now we're at a point 2 years later where we're starting to see this come to fruition. What do I mean by that? I'll kind of tee it up for you, and then you can walk us through some of your thoughts on what trades might even be possible in this league or what really isn't even going to happen. Because in 2016, when the new deal got done, some of the most average players were getting huge deals on these two-year deals or three-year deals. Now the teams want to trade those players, and they can't do it because other teams don't want to take on big contracts for low-level players. So the balance of power is sort of really top heavy. You warned us about that. You warned our listeners that this was going to be happening in the future. Here we are. Your teams just can't take on big cap salaries or big cap hits for average players. And then the other thing we're starting to see happen, which I think is really maybe the biggest reason that's going to affect this league, is as teams and GMs assess their rosters. You're seeing it in Cleveland a little bit, although they have some different problems, but you're going to see it in Boston with Marcus Smart, and you're going to see it in potentially a place like San Antonio with the Spurs. Obviously, the Detroit Pistons made a big move, but what you're seeing is teams kind of looking at their roster and saying, does it even make sense to move any of these pieces? Because whether or not we do, does that really help us compete with Golden State or the Houston Rockets right now? And if the answer is no, you can't leverage your franchise for the next 4 or 5 years if it's not even going to help you compete with the monster that's in Golden State or Houston right now. And I don't say Cleveland because that's a whole different situation. Unfortunately, that team is on a free fall. So the reality is, if you can't make a big deal and you can't take on a big contract for an average level player, and you're looking ahead and saying, we can't compete with the likes of the Warriors or the Rockets, I think this trade season for the NBA, Justin, is in kind of big jeopardy for really mixing these players around and also getting teams better.
You hit it right on the head, and there was an article out on earlier on Monday from Bobby Marks from ESPN talking about the state of the NBA right now. And what has happened is that basically all these teams overspent on average to mediocre guys. They way overpaid them. And now, really, there's no one that has that much room, and the teams that do have room really are only looking to take on these bad one-year contracts left so they can get a pick back. And we talked about really in the terms of a few weeks ago, we were talking about the Cavaliers, where, yeah, they have some pieces that they could potentially move, but no one wants to take on a contract, a bad contract that still has multiple years left on it. Yeah, these teams, a team like Phoenix or Chicago, which actually just took a deal when they sent Mirotic to the Pelicans, they did that because they got a first-round pick back and they ate Amir Ashik's $19 million deal that he had for one more year. So yeah, they'll eat that deal. They send a player away and they get a draft pick back. It seems like there is going to be a lot more teams that are trying to sell than teams that are trying to buy. And I think it's going to depress the market because you got to remember these teams are so close. These teams are going to blow out the luxury tax to the point where the owners are going to look and say, like you said, are we really in a position to compete with the Warriors or Rockets if I'm going to go out and spend X number of millions of dollars now over the cap and into this luxury tax to basically get knocked out? Or should we just stay put with what we have? So really, this influx of money that the league got, it seems like they would have been better to just do it in like segments or increments and not just dump all this money in 1 year into the cap, because now they're even talking about this coming free agent market is not going to be that strong. That guys like Marcus Smart, that 2 years ago probably would have got a deal similar to what Evan Turner got at $17.5 million a year, he's going to be lucky to get maybe even $8, $9, $10 million. So the market is changed tremendously. It's going to take basically filtering out some of these bad deals, these 2 and 3 year deals that were signed a few years ago, to open the market back up. So I think with that said, yeah, there are going to be some moves because there's teams, you know, like Oklahoma that seem to have some interest in an Avery Bradley. Obviously, DeAndre Jordan is out there on the trade market. But the teams that have the cap space, your Chicago Bulls, Phoenix Suns, even the Mavericks, they don't really seem like they're looking to spend on this type of, they're not going anywhere. So why are they going to go out and acquire a player like a DeAndre Jordan or someone like that? They're going to wait. They're going to hold their money. They're going to try to get assets back, build through the draft, and then maybe hit a home run in free agency. But I think with that said, it's really going to depress the market. And I think that's why you saw the Blake Griffin trade last week from a team like Detroit. If you're a free agent, do you really want to go to Detroit? No, it's got to be on the bottom five in terms of teams that are a free agent destination. So yeah, it's a bad contract that the Pistons took, but how else are they going to get a guy like Blake Griffin? How else are they going to sell tickets for their new arena? You've got to have some name power, some star power there. They traded away a guy in Avery Bradley that probably wasn't going to re-sign there anyways next year. And they traded away Tobias Harris, who has 1 year left on his deal. And they gave away a pick, but they got a name and they got a guy that they control his rights now for another 4 years. So for them, hey, what do they have to lose? He's still a guy I think that even teams see some value in, that they could potentially get something for him if it all went to hell in a handbasket. They couldn't do anything. But how else are they going to get stars in a place like Detroit?
No, and I think that's a great point. And the other thing that changed for them is they already jumped to the 8th spot in the East, and there's a very realistic chance that they can move to 7th or 6th by the time the season is up. For them, that move with Drummond and Griffin potentially re-energize that team to make a playoff run. Now, do they, you know, think they're going to win the NBA championship? Probably not, but it puts things together for them. The other thing we're starting to see is this huge, I mean huge, separation, almost a chasm between the top teams and the bottom teams in the NBA. And so, like you said, if you're looking at Brooklyn, Chicago, Atlanta, and Orlando in the Eastern Conference, or you're looking at Memphis, Phoenix, Dallas, or Sacramento in the Western Conference, they're dead and gone. I mean, we're almost halfway through the season, but we're not even talking about them as even a remote shot mathematically at the playoffs. They are dead and gone. Then you talk about a team like the Lakers, or back up in the East, the Knicks, or the Hornets. They're almost dead and gone, and they're not that far out of the 9th or 10th spots in the conference. So that's really hurting the trade market too, because as you said, none of those teams are going to take this huge flyer on a guy, spend a ton of money, so that they can, what, get back up to 500 and still be 10th in the rankings? It just doesn't make any sense. So now, Justin, shift that over to Cleveland. I'm becoming more and more frustrated with my guy LeBron. I'm becoming more and more frustrated with what's going on in Cleveland. We're not going to continue to rehash that. I know that our listeners are probably sick of hearing me talk about LeBron, but let's talk about it from a different perspective. There are rumors that Dan Gilbert is thinking about selling the Cleveland Cavaliers. Why is that important? Well, it's important to me because you start to read between the lines on some of this stuff. If Dan Gilbert is considering selling the Cavaliers, you might want to start thinking, what does he know? What does he think is going to happen? If he wants to unload himself of that franchise because he thinks that franchise value in maybe a year, when, let's say, number 23 is not there, is going to have a third of the value that it has now, what does he know? That's what I want to know from Dan Gilbert. You start to look at things like that. The other thing you look at is the GM and Dan Gilbert have been in talks, and they said, there's probably almost no chance that we trade that top five Brooklyn pick that we have. That's another read between the lines moment where you say, okay, if they're not going to do that, they might know that LeBron's not going to be there next year. That doesn't mean we know where LeBron's going to be, but he may not be in Cleveland. With that being said, Cleveland's now under the same mess that some of these other mid-level teams are at, because you have a team that might have one or two pieces. By the way, Isaiah Thomas is not working out. We might have to save that for a different show. We just don't have the time. But I couldn't be more disappointed right now in what I'm seeing out of Isaiah Thomas. Either he's A, not healthy, or B, just not the same player he was, or maybe C, just doesn't like it there. He seems to have a broken heart over the Boston thing, and maybe there's still something there. I don't know. We're going to have to break that down on another show. But at this point, the Celtics got the way better end of that deal right now. The Cavs are a complete mess. LeBron has his worst plus-minus since he was a rookie. I don't think that's all on him. I look at that as a factor of he's on the floor for 40 minutes a night, and so if they're always losing, his plus-minus is always going to be in the minus. You're looking at a lot of things with the Cavs that are a mess, but Justin, they're a mid-level team right now. They're about to lose the fourth spot. Excuse me, they're about to lose the third spot and drop to fourth because the Wizards are about to climb ahead of them. The Bucks may not be far behind. We might be talking about the Cavs as a fifth or sixth seed in these Eastern Conference playoffs, and I don't think they're going to fix that. I don't think they're going to make a big deal at the trade deadline either. So, Justin, you're looking at all these teams. Does anyone do anything to compete with the Warriors? And I have to include now the Rockets in that conversation. The Rockets blew out the Cavs the other. I mean, it just wasn't even a contest. So I think the Rockets and the Warriors, why can't that just be the finals this year?
It would be nice. We talked about that on another show where it wouldn't it be nice if the NBA just ranked, didn't do an Eastern-Western Conference, just ranked the top 16 teams and sort of let them play out. That would be fun to see. With your question with the Cavaliers, you know, with Dan Gilbert potentially talking about that could have ramifications on down the line. The story came out from Brian Windhorst that it seems to be a trust issue that's brewing. That LeBron doesn't feel like the organization is committed to winning or behind him, and the organization doesn't feel like LeBron is committed to them past the season, so they sort of have a standoff going on. Now, in 2017, when Forbes did their evaluation of teams' values, even with all the success the Cavaliers have had and having LeBron James, they were still only valued at 11th out of the NBA teams at $1.2 billion. How much is that team going to be worth if LeBron leaves there? They're going to drop into the 20s easily. That's not like it's that great of a market if LeBron's not there. And if you get a different owner in, who's to say that LeBron doesn't want to stay there? And this whole thing is the fact that he wants to get away from Dan Gilbert. So that seems to be part of this whole process with the Cavaliers. And Eric, I almost think back of, it'll be May when we'll have been doing our show now for a year. And if you come to me and you say, do you want to re-up for another year? Are you ready to go for another year? And I say, well, I don't know. You know, there's some other shows I have some interest in, and they seem to have better equipment, and I just don't like the way we do certain things. At some point, you're going to be like, you know what? You're a jackass. Like, I'm done with this. And I think you're starting to see some disinterest from the Cavaliers players of they're like, all right, what is LeBron doing? Is he coming? Is he going? Isaiah definitely doesn't seem to be a fit there right now. Now Kevin Love is out for potentially 8 weeks. So even the process of having all these guys work together and get it fixed, you're not really going to get that. That window is going to get much smaller when it comes to it. So, yeah, I don't know what the market is going to be. I think a team like Washington, Toronto, you know, we saw Boston go out and bring Greg Monroe in after the Suns bought him out. So there's some smaller moves that these teams are making, but they just don't have the cap flexibility to really do much. And even a team like Boston that has some assets, it doesn't seem like they want to make a move and trade an asset away unless it's for an established piece that's going to be there for a while. They don't want any rentals. You know, they got Monroe for about $5 million, and then he comes off the books. So they didn't lose anything by there. They already had an injury exception, I think, from the Gordon Hayward injury. So I don't really know. I don't see a lot of big deals. Again, we talked about maybe the Thunder go out and make a move for Avery Bradley, especially now that Robertson went down with that ugly injury that he had that took him out for a year. He was their best defensive player. You bring a two-way guy in like Bradley, maybe they can compete. But there's just, I don't see a lot of movement because the bad teams, it doesn't seem like they want to trade away good assets because obviously they want to build around them. And the assets that they want to trade, do they really do much and are they going to get much back? So I don't see a lot of big names being traded. DeAndre Jordan's name has been out there seemingly for the whole season. But, you know, the Clippers came out and sort of refuted that. I think if the right deal comes along, DeAndre Jordan, Lou Williams, Avery Bradley, I think the Clippers will be probably the busiest team in sort of distributing out some of their pieces and trying to get assets when it comes to Thursday.
Well, as I said, when we get to Thursday, we'll know if any of these trades went down. We'll know if there's any surprise trades that we didn't see coming. Every now and then that happens. These GMs are talking behind closed doors, and you get surprised by one or two things. But I think overall, we've probably got this one nailed that you're not going to see a lot of big surprises this year. Just too many challenges for the GMs in the NBA right now. Plus, you have teams we didn't even mention. You have teams like the Lakers, who quite frankly aren't going to spend a penny right now because they're setting everything up for the free agency period that they know is coming and trying to target one player. And there's going to be several teams like that. So you have that going on as well. It's a big game right now in the NBA. Who's going to get LeBron? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do that? And quite frankly, it just isn't going to move the needle for a lot of these teams. So that's going to do it for Talkworthy All-NBA, because we just had to figure out what's going to happen. Are there any teams that could do anything to reach out to the Warriors or Rockets? Honestly, I don't even know if the Cavs are going to make it to the finals, so we don't need to be talking right now, at least at this point, about the Cavs beating the Warriors. I think we need to figure out if it's going to be the Celtics or the Raptors beating the Warriors or the Rockets. So we'll let you know on the next episode what happened. That'll do it for Talkworthy. When we get back, it's going to be the lightning round. Justin, this week my mind was 100% on the Philadelphia Eagles in the Super Bowl, but there was other football news that hit us this week that really shocked me. You sent me a text that said Alex Smith has been traded to the Redskins. I almost fell out of my seat because although we knew that the Mahomes era was coming, I didn't really know that it was going to take place this soon, and I didn't know it was going to take place like this. The other thing I didn't see coming was Alex Smith to the Redskins. We named a lot of teams for Alex Smith that might be a great fit. Not that the Redskins wouldn't be a great fit, but I didn't think it was necessarily going to be them that picked him up. So Justin, walk us through your thoughts on Alex Smith to the Redskins.
Well, I was shocked when I saw it come through. And obviously, if you've listened to the pod, my brother's a huge Redskin fan. So immediately I had to tweak that waters and see what he was thinking, and not very happy, obviously, with that deal. Obviously, the talk had been the fact that Mel Kiper had Baker Mayfield going to Washington in his first mock draft that came out. So it seemed like, you know, obviously we knew that it was going to be tough for the Redskins to sign Kirk Cousins, but all of a sudden to go out and get Alex Smith, that was pretty gutsy by Washington. And I've heard Colin Cowherd talk about he feels that Washington actually upgraded quarterback. I feel like Colin Cowherd does not watch much football, because if he knew what Kirk Cousins had to play with this year, and we even talked about it on our show at times, where there was weeks where literally four to all five of the starters on Washington's offensive line would be out missing practice, and you had no idea who was actually going to play from week in to week out. You saw the injuries that took place. Chris Thompson went down with a bad injury. They lost Rob Kelly early in the year. Terrell Pryor didn't work out. Obviously, Jordan Reed is a walking mass unit. That guy's always hurt. He was never on the field consistently for this team. So I really felt like, obviously, as a Bronco fan, I'm excited because I feel like it's one less team now we have to compete with for Cousins. Now, the talk coming out of the Super Bowl was the Redskins are mulling putting the franchise tag on Cousins and forcing a team to basically trade for him. But there's a lot of moving parts with that, because now you've got $34 million locked up. If he immediately signs that deal and a team trades for him, now they have to have a $34 million cap hit on their books, or they have to sign him long term. So that's going to limit some of the leverage as well. I know Washington's going to try to recoup the third round pick they sent to the Chiefs, but that just seems like, at this point, pettiness. Like, okay, Washington, you guys screwed this up. You had every opportunity 2 years ago. You could have signed Cousins when the market was depressed, and you could have given him 5 years and $100 million and guaranteed 65 or 70 of it. And guess what? You've already paid him $44 million. So you've been on the hook this year for, what, another 26? It still would have saved you $8 million because you've gone out and given Alex Smith this huge deal, and he's in, what, his mid-30s? I feel like Washington, they just screwed this up from early on with Cousins. And we talked about it. Okay, maybe Cousins isn't a top-five quarterback, but these guys don't grow on trees. Ask the Cleveland Browns how hard it is to find a quarterback. It's not like you just walk into the draft and you just grab one of these guys and it's this is our quarterback for the next 15 years. It just doesn't happen that way. That's why, what, 50% of these guys are busts? And you just never know with that. So when you get one and he plays well, if you don't put the pieces around him, how can you blame him? And it feels like Washington never did that, and they sure as hell didn't believe in him. Even at the end of this year, Jay Gruden was talking about what kind of performance he had, and all he talked about was, well, we were 7-9. Regardless, we were 7-9. Well, that's not saying a lot about your quarterback, because you're not taking into account anything he had to deal with. So, hey, I'm glad he's out there. I won't mind if he comes to Denver. I'm hoping that we make a play for him. I'm hoping he doesn't break the bank. But I know Von Miller, CJ Anderson, a lot of the Bronco guys are pushing hard for him. So I wouldn't mind seeing him in the orange and blue.
I was going to say, our two teams, as far as the AFC teams, my Jets and your Broncos, could be in the bidding war for Kirk Cousins. So We'll see how high that price tag goes, but I would love to see Cousins on the Jets because, I mean, yeah, Washington may not believe in him, but I can tell you right now, Kirk Cousins would be the best quarterback that the Jets have had in many, many years.
Well, speaking, Eric, of Jets quarterbacks and former Jets quarterbacks, Tim Tebow in the news, and it came out that Vince McMahon is going to crank the XFL back up. I feel like we're back in the 90s and early 2000s again with Vince McMahon in the news, but he's bringing the XFL back. He's going to wait 2 years, try to do this the right way, and he put out an open invitation for one of your favorite athletes, Tim Tebow, to come to the XFL. Obviously, Tebow wants to go back to training camp with the Mets. He has a nice gig with ESPN, with the SEC Network. So what are your thoughts? Do you think it would be a good move for Timmy to join the XFL?
I really don't. I saw that too, and I'm actually excited about the XFL coming back because it was kind of an interesting mess. They screwed it up. They maybe had something interesting, and they just couldn't put all the pieces together. I think now, with everything the NFL is doing to basically upset fans, the XFL could go out there and maybe put a product on the field. If they keep it small, they got to keep their economies of scale small. Maybe, I don't know what he's talking about doing, but maybe 16 teams or something like that, and get some of these athletes that were former NFL players and maybe washed out just a little early but could have 4 to 5 years of name recognition and playability back in there on the field. But look, Tim Tebow just isn't one of them. I think that ship has sailed, and Tim Tebow, by far, one of the favorite college athletes I've ever had. He got the Florida Gators to the national championship. He won a Heisman. Great job from that perspective in college. He was, by most people's opinions, he was a bust in the NFL. I think he's just a quarterback that you would have really had to commit to because of the way he played. Now, his arm strength and some of the ways that he read defenses just really wasn't good enough for the NFL, but he also needed a team to commit to putting the right tackles and guards in front of him because of the style of football that he plays. So with Tim Tebow in the NFL, it would have been a 3 to 4 year project. That same thing is going to apply in the XFL, assuming they play the same style of football as the NFL. So I don't think it's the right move. I don't think he would succeed at this stage in his career in the XFL. He has also talked about his passion and renewed for baseball. I don't think you can go back on that. If you're Tim Tebow, I think you need to go to spring training with the Mets. You need to put all of your focus into that. You need to see how that goes if you're kind of renewing your passion with baseball. Now, he's not a young guy anymore in the world of sports, so he's probably only got a few years of testing out this baseball thing as well. But look, that's the path, Tim, that you're on now. You're not on the football path anymore. You could be a great analyst for the game of football. You can be a great commentator with ESPN. You obviously do a lot of good work out in the world. So I think there's a lot of avenues, motivational speaking, a lot of missions work, a lot of good things that Tim does. I don't think football is going to need to be one of them at this point anymore.
But boy, there's not a better name, though, for the XFL. If they could hitch their wagon to a guy like him from dragging a fan base there, that would be a big move for them. I don't know what, like you said, what their money is going to be, but I would be throwing a lot of it at Tim Tebow because there's no better name to start a league like that than have the fan base that Tim brings with him.
I could see guys more like RG3, you know, ending up there. You know, guys that are still relatively young, younger than Tebow, but have washed out of the NFL. Guys like Johnny Manziel, you know, could do something there.
Except for his little arrest issue.
Well, he's got some problems. But guys that maybe could have had a chance in the NFL, but the NFL competition is just too strong because there are guys like a Doug Flutie coming from the Canadian Football League and things. I mean, you hear these stories happen. And so, who knows? We could be thinking way outside the box here. Maybe the XFL grooms mid-20s level players that just needed a few more years to develop their skills, and that gives them a 4 to 5 year run in the NFL after that. But like I said, Tim Tebow, in my opinion, shouldn't be one of them. And I would really hate to, honestly, Justin, if they offer him a huge contract and he chases that for the money, unless he takes that money and donates a huge portion of it to different things for his foundations and things, then I would see that as really kind of an about face, a turn of what he said he was going to do, either with baseball or with, I don't know. I put myself in those shoes though, and A, money would talk for a lot of us, and you know, set up your family and things like that. But B, it's hard for us to judge these athletes because we've not been in that position. But in my opinion, I don't think he should do it. I really, really don't. I think it would be a mess. I don't think that's part of his life anymore, and I just don't. Quite frankly, I don't see him as a an NFL quarterback or even an XFL quarterback at this point.
All right, Vince, you're going to have to put the Money in the Bank briefcase up and give him a title shot. It looks like for if the money doesn't talk, maybe the WWE title will.
That's going to do it for episode 40 of Talk Back. Thanks for catching us every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on everywhere that podcasts are popular. Just search for Talk Back and look for the Golden Mic. That's where you'll find us. We have all of our episodes all the way back to last year, episode one, archived with Apple Podcasts, and they hit all of the major podcatchers that are out there. So please feel free to listen back, find out some of these things that we've said. Hey, we talked about that in episode 16. We talked about that in episode 25. Feel free to go back and check those out if you wish. Otherwise, we'd love to have you follow along with us for the remainder. We're almost done with season one of Talk Back. Justin, as you alluded to, it's hard to believe. But you can catch us also on Twitter and Instagram at @TalkBackFanTalk. Interact with us over there. You can catch us individually on Twitter. I'm at @TalkBackEric.
And I'm at @TalkBackJustin.
We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions, concerns, thoughts about the world of sports at large. There's going to be a lot to talk about in the weeks ahead. We're going to see another Tiger Woods sighting at Riviera coming up here shortly. We've got NASCAR back on the track this weekend at an exhibition event down in Daytona before the Daytona 500 kicks off later this month. So a lot of sports coming your way in the next few weeks. Justin, that's going to do it for this episode. I look forward to seeing you next week to talk more sports and see if anything happened big in these NBA trade deadline deals. Thanks for following along. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.